Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Flippy. Just flippy, man. All right, here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. Right here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, new episode. And don't forget the landing page. All previous episodes. So binge to your heart's content. Binge until you've got Elton Jim right up to the top of your throat. You can't even swallow anymore. Just about when you're just about ready to upchuck, then you could stop. But keep binging. WGNplus.com. So, did you hear my little, my little impromptu flippy? Just flippy, man. Elvis has died 40 years ago. And if you ever see the movie Jailhouse Rock, which I think is probably Elvis's best movie, his movies got very schlocky as his movie career went on. But Jailhouse Rock may have been the first one, I believe, if not one of the first ones, but I think it was the first one when he was still kind of cool. And there's just one scene where Elvis is, he's at this pool, and I don't know if it's a woman that comes up to him or something, or a guy, and I think it's a woman that comes up to him. I need to try to see them. I haven't seen the movie in years, but this scene and this phrase always jumps out at me. And so she said something to him, you know, oh, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he just goes, flippy, man, just flippy. I was just like, okay, how cool is that? Flippy, just flippy, man. So Elvis, we miss you. 40 years later, I was talking about this on the real radio a few days ago. It dawned on me as I was talking about Elvis marking the 40th anniversary of his death on August 16th, 1977. I realized that two of the major rock and roll icons, and two of among my favorites, who both died very young, Elvis 42, John Lennon 40, that I learned about their deaths while I was watching sporting events. And so I was told about Elvis's death by Cubs broadcaster Jack Brickhouse during a Cub game on August 16th, 1977, watching the game, as usual at that point. And then John Lennon, like many people, the death was announced on Monday Night Football by Howard Cosell. We have just gotten crazy, terrible news. John Lennon, former Beatle, has been shot in New York City. And I was like, what? And don't forget, and even as a 13-year-old kid, when Elvis died, it was like, you know, all Jack Brickhouse said was, entertainer Elvis Presley has been found dead. And you have to understand, it's so hard to explain what the world was like on a regular basis in, say, 1977 or even in 1980. There was no such thing as cable television. There was no such thing as CNN. Did not exist. There was no such thing as 24-hour news networks. There was no such thing, obviously, as the internet. There was no such term as social media. And so news was just, you know, there was times you learned news. You learned news at 5 p.m. and at 10 p.m. And then the rest of the day, you were not informed about anything. You did not know what was happening until 5 o'clock. And then they told you. And that's why they had these, at times with television, certainly with radio was more immediate, but with television, you knew, the only time you knew that something really important happened was they would literally break into programming. And it took a lot for them to break into programming. And this is what I'm saying, too. You have to understand, you know, we are so inundated with entertainment now. And that's what I'm going to talk about with Emily Arminetti in the Pop Culture Club later today. Because it reminded, as I was thinking about Elvis's death, it brought this question to my mind. We are so inundated now. We are such a celebrity-driven and entertainment-driven society. But you have to understand that 30, 40 years ago, even at that time, when someone like Elvis Presley died, when it was announced he died, it was not that initially from those in the news business. It was news. But if someone of Elvis Presley's stature would die today, I mean, you know, and we've seen it to some. Look at Prince, for instance, the way that happened. Young, unexpected, and all, it was just saturated. When Elvis died, like I said, I'm watching a Cub game. For that, for even for Jack Brickhouse to have said that in a Cub game was pretty crazy. But there was no, you know, regular programming on television did not stop. And so it was just kind of, in fact, at that time still, rock and roll music, even in the late 70s, was still viewed as young people's music. And yes, we all have heard of Elvis Presley, and he's well known. And I, when I talk about with Emily later, I'll tickle your funny bone with it now. I don't know if the funny bone's the right thing, but I really believe that the outpouring of sadness toward Elvis's death and the public reaction to it was really the beginning of what we would call pop culture, because no one expected the kind of outpouring of sympathy and sadness. The streets of Memphis were lined with people for Elvis's funeral, which no one expected initially. And this white limousine was driving through the streets, and the streets were, the pictures, you can still go online and find them. It was, people were shocked to see this. Now that would be common practice. But it, and even, like I said, Graceland now has become a tourist attraction. That was not planned out. When Elvis died, the family didn't say, well, now we can open up the house and make money from it. The reason the light bulb went on, because when Elvis died, people from not just Memphis, but all over the country came and didn't know what to do. But they wanted to show their sympathy and their connection, their sadness, and they wanted to share that with people. Once again, no social media. You got to. We had at that time, you had to do things physically. You couldn't just hit a couple of buttons and have a virtual community, you know, sharing in the grief. You had to actually get up and put your pants on and go show your grief with other people. And that, and there is something to be said for the humanness, the communal grief that you share with someone to help you get through it. But they didn't know what to do, so they went to Elvis's house and stood outside the gates. And people just, as the week, as the two or three or four days between when he died and when his funeral was, it just became this organic meeting ground for people. And people were coming from all over the country. And then after that became a focal point for grief for several weeks and days initially, and then when they saw the line of people that lined the funeral procession throughout Memphis, that's when they said, well, wait a minute, I mean, there's something here, and we would like to give people the opportunity. And that's when Graceland became a tourist attraction. But it happened organically. It wasn't because someone said, we're going to go to Graceland now, like a flash mob. There were no flash mobs. Nobody set up something. And so, and even when John Lennon died, when John Lennon was shot, It wasn't just because he got shot in front of the Dakota building where he lived in New York. But once again, people from all over the country, especially New Yorkers, when Lennon got shot that night, as news spread throughout the city, people rushed to the Dakota just to be, and for weeks they were standing outside the Dakota. And you can see the photos of that, and people had signs, and it was just, you know, and they're crying and everything. And that was really, you know, very similar to the way Elvis did. And as I said, when the reaction to Elvis died, here's this popular entertainer, especially with the baby boomer generation, which at the time was the biggest generation of people and growing, the Elvis meant something to them. And so I really think that the outpouring toward Elvis's death really started to change our culture and make the people in the media sort of say, okay, wait a minute, we can't just keep treating this like it's some little side thing. I mean, once again, you watch the news today, and sprinkled throughout the fires and the tornadoes and the earthquakes and the murders and all the other stuff, they will have stories about Taylor Swift and Beyonce's babies and all this other stuff. I got news for you, folks. That rarely happened on the news. The news was not sprinkled. They may have had an entertainment reporter once a week who would come on and do a 2-minute segment and would talk about this stuff. But that was not a part of the news rundown for the day. Tickets are going on sale for Lollapalooza? I guarantee you Walter Cronkite never read that. Today at Lollapalooza, there was no Lollapalooza. And if there was, Walter Cronkite was not telling you when tickets went on sale. Completely different perspective on what was important and what wasn't. And I really believe that Elvis's death played a major role in the society and the major mainstream media to sort of go, okay, whoa, maybe we need to start servicing. There's something out here that we have not been. I mean, at that time, it was politics. I mean, that was it. Politics. Everybody knew politicians. Politicians were rock stars. But when Elvis died, rock stars became rock stars to the mainstream. And then obviously when MTV happened, say, 5, 6, 7 years ago after Elvis's death, then that was a huge shift in the entire culture. And the fact that not only was it music videos, but it was the fact that MTV was on for 24 hours and you could watch Michael Jackson's Thriller or Boy George's Karma Chameleon or Prince's Purple Rain at 2 in the afternoon or 2 in the morning or from 2 in the afternoon to 2 in the morning, whatever you wanted to do. And that saturation, that 24 hours of that is what really, you know, changed the way we look at entertainment. Because suddenly it was around us at all times, and we were now informed. And we knew when Michael Jackson had a new video coming out because it was going to get its world premiere 2 days on MTV. So we will talk about a little more in depth. But yeah, I mean, the Elvis thing, it's 40 years later. It really, to me, was a turning point of how our culture has changed. And I wanted to mention this too, talking about the way culture has changed in the last 40 or 50 years. So recently, Chicago's beloved Picasso sculpture, which stands in Daley Plaza and has been standing there for 50 years, August 15th, 1967 was the date that it was officially unveiled, when the first Mayor Daley, Mayor Richard J. Daley, was mayor. And the Picasso has always been an interesting focal point for this city. As time has gone on, we have used it as a as one of our icons. We have used it as a marketing image for the city on all our little tchotchkes and little mugs and everything. But 50 years ago, the Picasso still is a mystery to many people. The biggest mystery is, what is it? And my point is, I'll tell you what it is. It's a Picasso. That's what it is. What it stands for doesn't really matter. But in 1967, not only was the culture, again, changing, where modern art, especially with Picasso and Cubism, which is basically deconstructing what we see into smaller pieces. We look at a tree and it looks like a tree. Picasso looked at a tree and said, well, what if we took all those parts apart from that tree and put them into different manner and shape? Would that still be a tree? It's the parts of the tree. That's kind of what Cubism was. It was a deconstructing of what we saw or what we expected. And, you know, Chicago is still, for as much as we have grown as an international city, a sophisticated city, certainly our architecture and art has, we have grown in our reputation. But still, for the most part, Chicago, is as much as it is a international city, is a city of neighborhoods. And in those neighborhoods, it is a city of the working man. That still has not changed. We are not a city of elites. And that's fine. But we are still very much meat and potatoes. You talk to a Chicagoan about a restaurant, and I guarantee you, the first thing they say is, good portions. They won't even tell you if the food was good or not. Oh, well, great portions. Took some home. So important to take something home from the restaurant. Oh, the portions were big. How was the food? It wasn't bad, but the portions were amazing. If you watch those shows like Check Please, what's the first thing you say? Lot of food for the money. We are still stuck on that. That's why so many people, they go to a fancy restaurant like a Spiaggia or something like that, and it comes and, you know, it costs $40, and there's three little pieces of meat. The average Chicagoan says, what the hell am I going to do with this? It's about the taste there. But the average Chicagoan likes to have their bang for their buck. Good portions. So you can only imagine. I was 3 years old, so I certainly have no clue as to what was going on. But in 1967, for Chicago, under, you know, the iron fist, talk about an iron throne. with Game of Thrones, in terms of a powerful mayor, there was only one power in Chicago. There were no seven kingdoms fighting for the Iron Throne in Chicago. It was the father of dragons was Mayor Richard J. Daley. He sat in the Iron Throne, and he was a Southsider. He was a meat and potatoes guy. At least that was the image he portrayed. He lived in a bungalow on the South Side, even though he was mayor. But I think he also had some champagne tastes. I don't think he just let that be known to the huddled masses there, the great unwashed who voted for him because he wanted to be one of the people there. You know, I think there's nothing better than a fish. I'd love for people to one day go out on the Chicago River and at lunchtime catch their lunch, because there's nothing better than a fish. He said that one time. Could you imagine eating anything out of the Chicago River? The fish in the Chicago River don't even want to eat anything out of the Chicago River. So you can only imagine, in this meat and potatoes town, as Carl Sandburg described us, the hog butcher of the world, in this meat and potatoes town, this working class town, a Picasso the epitome of modern art, the epitome of abstract art, the epitome of this new generation. I mean, everybody in Chicago, when they say a work of art, they basically meant a picture that was painted. Very literal. So could you only imagine? So now somebody's, and, you know, the name Picasso, obviously, you know, was internationally known. And Picasso at that time was probably in his late 50s, early 60s. Probably the, still is, considered probably the greatest or one of the greatest artists of all time. But he certainly was at his peak or his pinnacle. And he decides to donate this 50-foot sculpture to Chicago. And I guess Chicago actually did have to, you know, kind of try to negotiate for this. I don't know if Picasso just said, hey, I've got this, I'm having a yard sale. I got this 50,000-foot brown thing in my yard, and I don't know what to do with it. I'm trying to declutter here. Does anybody want this? So apparently Chicago, you know, went to Picasso and said, well, here's why we should get it. And apparently one of the things that was a determining factor was, you know, Ernest Hemingway was born in Oak Park. And Picasso knew Hemingway. He goes, oh, I taught, you know, because Picasso, you know, was Spanish. And so bullfighting is very much in his culture. And, you know, Hemingway ran with the bulls and went to Spain. And so he actually said when the Chicago contingency went out there, they were talking about Abraham Lincoln and Carl Sandburg and all these great people that had connections to Illinois and Chicago as the reason why they, you know, Chicago should be chosen for this. And then they mentioned that Hemingway was born in Oak Park. And so he goes, oh, I know him. I taught him all he knows about bullfighting. He's from Chicago. So I don't know if Papa, if you will, was responsible. But anyway, Chicago gets granted this thing. And so on August 15th, 1967, which was formerly known as the Civic Center, now it's Daly's Plaza since named after Richard J. Daly, right in front of, you know, the Civic Center, which is now the Daly Center, and right across the street from City Hall and all the governmental buildings. That were, you know, City Daly Center used to be the meeting ground of the city. It used to be the middle of the city. It's where people congregated. It was where people, as I said before, politics were so important. It was the meeting place of Chicago. So it made sense at that time to put this 50-foot sculpture, this by this international artist there, because it's the center of the city. Everybody will see it. Everybody will have a chance to see it and deal with it and look at it and appreciate it, whatever. So let's put it, you know, when you buy something that you like, you put it in a spot where the most people can see it. So everybody congregated and they had a huge unveiling. And when they took the covers off of this, apparently, the meat and potatoes people of Chicago looked at this thing, as they still do today, as sophisticated, hopefully, as we are from an artistic standpoint. They looked at, what the hell is that? You know, up to this point, the only statues in Chicago were people on horses, generals, very literal. There's whoever, you know, on a horse pointing or something. So then this huge abstract piece of art is unveiled, you know, and everybody's just kind of looking at it like, what? If you ever saw the Producers movie, when the Springtime for Hitler, you know, they show the audience, everybody's just got their mouth open. And a lot of people in Chicago were the, you know, came to see this Picasso, this big deal. There's the mayor. He come out to you know, dedicate this thing, and they take these huge you know, unveil these things, big tarps, and then the brown Picasso is staring at everyone. And needless to say, one of the great radio hosts and authors from Chicago, Studs Terkel, apparently, he went out there with a microphone, and he was asking people, like, what did they think about it? And I mean, some said it was a horse. Some said it was butterfly wings. Some said it was a flying nun. Some said it was an Afghan hound. You know, people said it was hideous. What the heck is that? What is this? A lot of Chicago politicians, you know, once again, not the most sophisticated of the lot, you know. Oh, this guy's just making fun of us. He gave us his garbage. What the heck is that? We don't even know what it is. And Picasso never said what it was. Some people wanted it to immediately taken out. I mean, it caused a furor. But to old man Daly's credit, he knew. Even if he didn't know what it was, and even didn't appreciate it, what Daly understood was people. And what Daly understood was how to connect. And he knew that to make Chicago an international city, you gotta take some of these things. And he even said, hopefully what is weird today will be familiar at some other time. And so that was kind of the view. And so to Daly's credit, you know, they put that thing in a prominent spot and it was there, and a lot of people didn't like it, and he embraced it because he knew that Chicago got it. Paris would love to have had it. Any city in the world would have loved to have had a Picasso, and Chicago got it. And Daly understood what that meant. And soon after that, Joan Miró gave right across the street from the Picasso, there's a smaller statue from Miró, which is right across the street. It's kind of hidden, which is sad because Miró is a very well-known French painter as well. And then if you go near, I believe it's like Dearborn and maybe Madison, Monroe, right by the Chase building, there's a beautiful four-paneled color mural by Marc Chagall. But it was because of Picasso dedicating this to Chicago. Then other world-renowned artists said, well, wait a minute, if Picasso will have something in Chicago, then I want something in Chicago. And it helped to elevate Chicago's reputation as not only a big city, but as an artistic city, as a cultural city. So Daly knew what he was doing. But still, the Picasso remains a great mystery. We have come to embrace it. We still don't know what it is. We'll put a Cub hat on it when they go to the World Series. We'll put a Hawks helmet on it when they go to the Stanley Cup. They put a Bears helmet on when they go to the Super Bowl. Haven't had that Bears helmet on it very long, though, or too many times, if you know what I mean. So it's certainly ingrained into our Chicago fabric. And so as it celebrates its 50th anniversary, 50th birthday, if you will, it is interesting, you know, that people still look at it with a little kind of, well, I don't know what it is, but it's cool. Or, as I said before, it's a Picasso, and that's all that really matters, folks. What it is isn't as important. What it signifies, or what it is to you, is what's important. But the important thing is for you to look at it and appreciate it as a piece of art. Now, what I will tell you is, because I've been fortunate enough, and I really do like Picasso's work, I have seen quite a few of Picasso exhibitions at museums around the world, and I've been lucky enough to go to Barcelona and see the Picasso Museum and see, for instance, his Guernica and a lot of just all of his work. If you look at a lot of his work, the image of our Picasso is most likely it is a woman. If you look at the way he represented many of his wives and his mistresses, that's the image for whatever reason. So it's a woman. Okay, but who cares? But let's say it is a woman. Well, then, interestingly, you know, maybe what Picasso was saying and giving it to Chicago was, well, you know, let her watch over you like every good mother does. Maybe it's a place, a nurturing kind of thing, to come to and be nurtured by his sculpture. As I've said many times, it doesn't matter what it is. The literal thing of what it is. What it is a Picasso. What it is an amazing work of art by one of the world's greatest artists. And Chicago should be proud and excited and celebrate the fact that we have this amazing sculpture as part of our city. And sometimes I think, as what happens with things that are around for a long time, we start to take it for granted. And I really believe that, look, we all move, right? We don't always live in the same place. 50 years is not a bad run for one spot. But 50 years after the dedication, and I will read you something that classic that Mike Royko wrote about and only the way he could when it was unveiled. But what I'm saying is, I think it's time we move the Picasso to another part of the city. Daily Center is not the central meeting ground anymore. It's not a tourist attraction. It's not where the movers and shakers of the city congregate anymore. It was 50 years ago. It was the center and the seat of the city. But today, as we are trying on a regular basis, which makes sense, we are promoting Millennium Park as our tourist attraction, as our meeting ground. They've got the fountains that spew out the water and the kids play in there. You've got the Bean. You've got a piece of architecture by one of the world's leading architects, Frank Gehry, the pavilion. And meanwhile, so there's all this activity, and there's, like I said, the Bean is now instantly became a tourist attraction and this piece of art that everybody flocks to and knows right off the bat, the Bean. More people know the Bean than they know the Picasso. Picasso's been there for 50 years. But you know why? Because the Bean is at a spot where more people are going to every day. They're seeing it and interacting with it and appreciating it. Meanwhile, the Grand Am, a Picasso, is sitting in front of a building that is brown. The Picasso is brown. It kind of blends in. You almost can't even see it from a distance. So aesthetically, it's surrounded by old boxy buildings, brown concrete buildings. It's dark around there. There's not even a lot of light around Daley Plaza. The other side of the coin is, think about who really sees the Picasso on a regular basis. The building that it's up in front of, that's a court building. That's for defendants and lawyers and convicts. Now, I apologize, but I just feel I have nothing to base this on except my own sensibilities. But I'm thinking that when those buses pull up and the guys in the orange jumpsuits get out and they're walking into the building, I don't think they stop and go, "My God, that's a Picasso. That's amazing. Look at the lines. Look at the structures." Basically, the people that are enjoying the Picasso most are lawyers and convicts. I don't think they're appreciating it. I think they're mad that they have to walk around it to get to the door. It's an obstruction. It's an obstacle. It doesn't belong there anymore, folks. It's been there for 50 years. That's not the center of the universe. The center of the universe in Chicago now, in terms of people and energy and fun and discovery and beauty and aesthetics, is Millennium Park. It's not Central Park by any means, but it's what we have. And I believe that we need to move the Picasso out of Daley Center, out of Daley Plaza, and put it in Millennium Park and let it get its due and respect. That is a cultural spot now. There's a Frank Gehry there. There is the Bean. There's the Maggie Daley Park. There is congregating. It's a meeting place for all the people, whether it's tourists or locals. And they should be enjoying the Picasso. And the Picasso should be enjoying being put in a place of prominence. That's the new place of prominence in Chicago. And how great would the Picasso look when it's not on a backdrop of a building of the same color, a big boxy, ugly building of the same color? But how great would it look with the sky and the lake behind it? It would then truly be able to be viewed as a work of art. And it would create an amazing new semi-skyline for Millennium Park in the city. You'd look up there and you'd see the Geary Pavilion, that round steel structure. And you'd see the bean. And in the middle of that, this is what I would do. There's space. Believe me, there's space. You put the Picasso in the middle. Or to the side, wherever it fits. But in a place of prominence. And it will immediately add to the energy and excitement of Millennium Park, as well as aesthetically to what a Millennium Park would look like as a postcard. And it would certainly help the prominence of a Picasso in a city. Cities would kill to have that. It's done its job at the Daily Center. For several years, I was complaining that in Daily Plaza once again, because in Chicago we don't like change, and it's always been done that way, right? So why change it? So they jam-packed that Kris Kringle Market into that little square postage stamp of Daily Plaza. And they had the tree and the market and the booths for food and Santa. And they were all in this postage stamp. A couple of years ago, my wife and I couldn't even get in. When we got finally in, it took us 20 minutes for them to let us in. And when we got in, we didn't even know if we were in the line to see Santa, to get a potato pancake, or to go see the tree. And I would say, okay, folks, we got to take some of this out. Why can't you use something at Millennium Park? Move the tree there. The tree doesn't belong next to, once again, the spot where no one goes. Put the tree in Millennium Park. I was saying that for 5 years. I doubt if what I said mattered, but it made sense. And thankfully, I think 2 years ago, they finally moved the official Chicago tree at Christmas time to Millennium Park. Hello. So, what I say, happy 50th birthday to our Picasso, but it's time she moved. Let's find a spot for her in Millennium Park. But let me read you this. This is from Mike Royko. And this is why we miss the media and the way it used to be here in this city. Here's what Mike Royko wrote about the Picasso. He said, when it first was unveiled, the Picasso has a long, stupid face and looks like some giant insect that's about to eat a smaller, weaker insect. It has eyes that are pitiless, cold, and mean. But why not? Everybody said it had the spirit of Chicago. And from thousands of miles away, accidentally or on purpose, Picasso did capture it. Up there in that ugly face is the spirit of Al Capone. The cop scandals. The settlers who took the Indians, but good. Its eyes are like the eyes of every slum owner who made a buck off of small and weak. Of every building inspector who took a bribe. Or from a slum owner who made it all possible. Any big-time real estate operator will be able to look into the face of the Picasso and see the spirit that makes this city's rebuilding possible and profitable. It is all there in that Picasso thing. The I will spirit. The I will get you before you get me spirit. Picasso has never been to Chicago, they say. But you'd think he'd been riding the L all his life. We still don't know what it is, but it's a Picasso. And it deserves to be put in a place of prominence. Let's move the Picasso to Millennium Park. And We now take a little walk down the stairs of a secluded room in a far-off place, away from everyone else, called the Pop Culture Club. And we say the secret word, and we're allowed in. Do you know the secret word to get into the Pop Culture Club, Emily Amernetti?
I was afraid you were going to ask me.
Didn't you get the? They didn't send you the little description of the secret handshake?
No, I don't think so. But I have my card. I mean, I'm a card carrying member of the club.
So you've never really been in the back room, then, have you?
I don't know, but you make it sound like you. It's all like a bit Silence of the Lambs, like you have in a well, cellar somewhere.
It will rub the oil on its skin,
and then it will discuss pop culture.
So you've never seen the room with the fireplace then. You haven't been in the cool area yet. I'll talk to somebody. I've got some pull at the Pop Culture Club, so I invented it. So, because right now in that room I'm talking about, I'm the only one in there.
Right. You're the only one who has the password.
Yeah. Just so you know, just a hint, if you want to do some homework, the password, surprisingly or not, is an Elton John reference. So just for, if you want to, so if you want to just do a little research and come up with some things, it could be Goodbye Norma Jean.
No, it could be Leave On.
It could be Leave On. Yeah.
That would be a good one.
Yeah, that's not bad. But it wouldn't be that simple. Like if it was Leave On, to your point, then it would probably be, the secret word would be Alvin Tostig, because that's Levon's father.
Oh, jeez. Now
song,
you're going, like,
Alvin,
silly.
Alvin Tostig has a son today, and he shall be Levon. It's the word.
You're like the only person who can decipher Elton John lyrics.
It could be Crocodile Rock.
But there's like, you know that there's a whole group of people out there, our former colleagues, and they only know the words to I can't remember the name of the song.
Which one?
Tiny Dancer.
Yeah.
They only know the lyrics to Tiny Dancer because of you.
Why?
I can't believe you don't remember this, because when we worked together, because that those lyrics are kind of hard to decipher.
Yeah.
Especially at certain points of the song. And that song became, like, kind of had a renaissance in 2000 because it was in Almost Famous.
How it became a hit.
And we were working together at the time.
Yeah.
And I remember in the office, some of the girls were talking one day about the song, and they couldn't understand lyrics. And this was like, remember, this is back before, like, everything you could ever want to find was, like, on the internet.
Exactly.
And you broke down the lyrics for everyone.
Oh, really?
Lay me down in sheets of linen. You cannot, that lyric is, like, impossible to grasp just listening to the song.
You've had a busy day today.
Yeah.
She was the seamstress for the band.
Exactly.
Count the headlights on the highway. That was Bernie Taupin's girlfriend, then first wife. And that was about sort of being on the road. And the funny thing about Tiny Dancer now is Bernie Taupin had a very, very bitter divorce from that woman. He's been married four times. And that was his first marriage. And he does not like that woman at all. From what I understand.
Oh, and she's forever memorialized.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. This is the best part of it. So if you buy the album that the song is on, it's on the Madman Across the Water album, and the album comes with a booklet of all the lyrics. And each page was the lyrics, and there was a lot of different little imagery, on each page. It's really a cool little book. Well, it's a big booklet if you get the vinyl. And I think it's out on vinyl again, and they've reproduced the booklet, so it's cool. But on Tiny Dancer, the first song on the album, in the right corner, there's a picture of Maxine Taupin, and it says "With Love to Maxine," right?
Oh.
So I mean, there's no question, because apparently she was a dancer, And certainly it includes some imagery, you know, Blue Jean Baby, L.A. Lady. There's imagery of L.A. because, you know, when the British came over to California, their eyes popped out with the women and the weather. I mean, they couldn't believe it, coming from a dismal place where straight teeth were not the norm. To come to California.
Watch it. You don't want to.
No, I love. No, no. I don't know what happened to fluoride over there. But there is imagery of L.A. and this discovery and the kind of free and easy thing. But it was this. There's no question. There are definite. There's specific references to her and her place within their inner circle and being on the bus ride, you know, going from town to town, you know, count the headlights on the highway. And she was the seamstress for the band, and the piano man makes his stand in the auditorium. Obviously that's Elton. And she knows the words, she knows the tune she hums. She knew, you know, she sang the songs, you know, because right. She was going out with the lyricist who wrote them. So it's all there. Well, right. 40 years later, to your point, so Tiny Dancer experiences this amazing renaissance. It was always it was released as a single in 1971 and didn't even, I mean, barely crack the top 40. Was not a hit at all, and became, for those of us who were fans and on FM radio that didn't play the top 40 hits, it was a popular song, and he would play it in concert quite a bit, but it was not well known at all. It was not considered one of his greatest hits, and it was not considered, you know, a must play at a concert. And if it wasn't for Cameron Crowe.
Yeah, Cameron Crowe, yeah. Mm-hmm.
For putting it in that, in Almost Famous, and framing it in such a way that it really came to represent the era.
Yeah.
That it became, now Elton John has to play Tiny Dancer. And I heard, actually, Tiny Dancer may be his most downloaded song.
Well, that's also part of Cameron Crowe's, like, his, I don't want to say, maybe it is his signature a bit. Like, he is very good, not just with, like, you know, writing screenplays, directing, but with the music as well. Most of his movies have amazing soundtracks, and then there's always something that really catches on. But Tiny Dancer and Almost Famous definitely did.
Oh yeah,
and
well,
I can't believe you don't remember. You were practically holding a tutorial, in, like, you know, this cubicle, you know, group of people in a cubicle learning the words to Tiny Dancer.
Oh, you know, I do vaguely remember that. But I don't remember it as clear as you do.
Tiny Dancer Seminar of 2000.
Tiny Dancer 101.
Right.
Next week I'm going to do Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me. But to back to my point, so about 10, 15 years ago, you know, the song takes on this prominence. So this, you know, this new renaissance. So Rolling Stone does a special issue about the best songs, like 500 best rock and roll songs, right? So Tiny Dancer, or maybe it was the top 100, I can't remember, 200, but regardless of what it was, Tiny Dancer is mentioned, is listed. So they get some quotes from Elton and Bernie Taupin, the lyricist who wrote the song. Well, in a huge effort to rewrite history and get his wife, or his ex-wife, who he does not care for, out of any connection with the song, even though when it was initially released, it said to with love to Maxine,
right,
with her picture next to the lyrics. Now he says, "Well, that song was about, you know, the women of L.A. and the feeling of L.A. and it wasn't about one person. It was about" just the whole kind of scene and the freedom of the times and, you know, the beautiful women of the times. And, you know, and he's completely tried to redefine that song. And even Elton, I think, initially would introduce it and say, this is about Bernie's ex-wife. And then he would go, oh, he doesn't want me to say that anymore. So now that's the official story, is that it's not right. about any one person. It's about a mood or a feeling. And it's like, okay, Bernie, we know what, you know,
Bernie
those of us
needs to move on. especially yeah. if he's been married like four times.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know why? I think, and I don't have this substantiated, but I've heard rumors that the one reason why he can't move on, literally, is because back then, now this is, you know, 45 years ago. Well, no, they didn't divorce till about 75, 76. But, you know, she was married to him during the heyday, right? When they made their money and all the major hits. From what I understand, in the divorce, she may have gotten a big chunk of his, like, future royal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so, like, whatever he makes, he may have to give her a big chunk even today.
Right, right, right.
So I think, to your point about moving on, it's kind of hard to move on when you're still giving 50% of your money away to someone that you don't like.
Right. His wages are being garnished.
I mean, he's literally, yeah, right. In fact, he's got a huge, beautiful, you can go online and look at it. He's selling. He's got an amazing ranch in Santa Barbara, in Santa Ynez. And it's up for sale, and they do like a virtual tour of it, and he gives the tour, and it's gorgeous because he was like he became the Brown Dirt Cowboy from Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt. The place was a ranch, and it even has like an arena, you know, for like rodeos. It's just off the charts. But I don't know if Bernie's just trying to, you know, downsize or if he needs the money. You know, because think about it. Well, yeah. Because, you know, Elton still makes money because he tours, but Bernie doesn't get money from that. You know, he doesn't get money from the concerts. Right. He's not playing those concerts. So there's no doubt that that catalog is worth a lot of money, but it's not certainly probably making as much money as it used to. So anyway, that's a little sideline on Bernie Taupin. So let me, what I wanted to talk about with you today was something that sort of struck me. I was thinking about, you know, it's 40 years now that Elvis passed away.
Right.
And you were not.
I just saw Priscilla Presley was on the Today Show. Was that this morning?
Oh, was it?
Yeah. This morning.
Yeah. We're taping this actually on August 16th, even though this will, you know, post on the next week. But yeah, so today is actually the day that he passed away. Now, you were not born, right?
What year was it? 1977? Yes, I was.
Oh, you were.
Elvis died the day after my sister's birthday, and we used to talk to her about that.
The day after?
Yeah, the day after she was born, because he died in 1977, right?
Yeah, right, August 16th.
Yeah.
Well, that would be, I mean, I know you're more of a word person than a numbers person, but you can do math, right? I mean, 40 plus 77 is what?
Yes, I can do math.
She's like, was it 77 or not?
That's the other reason I know that it was 40 years ago.
Oh, right, because so your sister just turned 40 then, right?
My killer math skills.
Yeah. So your sister turns 40 then?
She turned 40 yesterday, yeah.
Yeah.
She did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
we're going to celebrate with her today, actually, tonight.
Where are you? Are you in the city?
I'm not in the city. I was gonna try to get to the city maybe to see you today, but I just knew.
But you're in Chicago?
I am. Yeah.
Where are you? You have to tell me where you're at. But
I'm in a well in your basement.
I can't believe you came to the area and you didn't even tell me.
I didn't listen. I'm coming back. I told
you. So when did you get here?
In like 10 days.
When did you get here?
Listen.
No.
I got here.
When did you get here?
I got here.
Are you telling the host to listen? Hello?
I got here.
You know, I could just do this right now, and she's gone. So I don't know what Emily's even talking about. Are you still talking?
No.
See, I just, you know what?
Of a button.
Do you know that I just shut your microphone off?
Okay, now I can really let it rip.
Yeah. She says, no, listen. Wow.
I
have you gotten ballsy in the last year?
Okay. Excuse me, sir. Yeah.
No, but I mean.
With respect,
it's too late for that.
I was going to message you and say, I'm here this week, but then I realized.
This week? What, this week?
Yeah, but I have. But I have a bunch of family commitments. I have a rehearsal dinner, a wedding, and my sister's birthday today. So my entire week pretty much has been taken out.
When did you get to Chicago?
That's why I came here.
When did you get here?
I got here Saturday night.
Oh! It doesn't matter. I couldn't have seen you any of those days anyway.
No, you've been very busy.
Very busy.
Filling in on WGN. I know.
Very
I saw that.
Busy.
But
very busy.
But no. But I. So I am going
to. But now I have nothing to do.
But so. I'm. But I am coming back. I told you I'm going to be here twice in August. So I am coming back.
Yeah, but you're so. But you're going to come back for the
in a week and a half.
You're going to come back for the John Cougar concert, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or John Mellencamp.
John Mellencamp.
What night are you going?
Cougar.
Which night are you going?
I'm going Saturday night.
Okay. I'll see, because I'm still deciding whether I want to go or not.
No, you should definitely go.
Yeah, I would like to go. I'd like to see him, but at the same time, he's such a curmudgeon. I don't know if I want to see him.
That's okay, though.
Is
who
it?
Who cares?
Yeah.
Who cares if he's a curmudgeon? It'll still be fun.
I can't believe.
And it's for Vinny.
Do you have a pavilion or lawn seats?
Oh, always lawn.
Oh, of
always
course.
Lawn. I would way rather be in the lawn at Ravinia.
Yeah. Well, you're going to be drunk with all your wine and.
Wait, all of a sudden I'm a drunk. Oh, you're going to be passed out. In the
you're going to probably be passed out. This is your Lollapalooza.
Okay, I'm not that old.
but anyway, so what I was getting at was, I was thinking about it was 40 years ago, and when Elvis was, when the news came out. As I said, I learned about it from Jack Brickhouse, who used to broadcast the Cub games. I was watching a Cub game, and he announced it during the game, and there was this spontaneous and organic reaction to that all around the country, and then people started to congregate at Graceland, and that's how Graceland became a tourist attraction. And you can still go back and look at the pictures and see how, I mean, the fans just lined the streets as the white limousine went through his funeral procession. And I really believe that was really a turning point where the powers that be in the mainstream media realized, you know, this entertainment stuff, this means something to people, because entertainment was relegated to, you know, the back pages of the newspaper at all, if it was there at all. It certainly was not on the news on a regular basis. You know, when Farrah Fawcett had a baby, it was not on the news. You know what I mean?
Right.
That was not what was done on the news. The news was serious, and entertainment news was frivolous. Maybe it was on once a week. So what we are experiencing now, I'm just wondering, have we just become, has pop culture become our culture? You know what I mean? Are we just a celebrity driven? I mean, what would you think? What do you think? I mean, we have a reality guy in the White House.
Right.
So,
well, yeah, I mean, I look at it like, I don't necessarily think that pop culture is transforming our culture, or if it's such that the world has changed, and as the world changes, it's making pop culture more ubiquitous, more deeply ingrained in the fabric of our society. I mean, like you said, you know, news used to be hard-hitting news. Now it's like the lines are so blurred.
Oh, right.
So
I mean,
if you're on the front page of CNN, I mean, you could be reading about, you know, what's happening in Charlottesville one minute, and then just below that, you'll have a headline about some celebrity doing something somewhere that's, at the end of the day, really not news.
Yeah, like,
but it is kind of where we find ourselves today, I think.
Yeah, I mean, perfect example is that Taylor Swift, court case.
Oh, that trial.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, that would, I guarantee you that 40 years ago, that would not, you would never have heard about that unless you read, you know, Photoplay magazine or some teen magazine. But there is no way that Walter Cronkite would have been reporting on that.
Right.
Today's Taylor Swift, you know, no way. I mean, I'll tell you, there's a lot of the rock stars of the 1970s are breathing a huge sigh of relief that they were not popular in today's world.
For sure, the
debauchery that went on in the 70s, those people who are now, you know, have legendary status, they may have been blackballed and kicked out of the business for some of the things that they did, but none of that was covered by legitimate mainstream media in any meaningful way. It may have been reported, but it died the next day.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think a lot of this stuff, like, you know, as you said, I mean, when Elvis died, you said, you know, they probably start to realize, like, oh, wow, you know, people are really into this. People really are personally invested in this kind of stuff and emotionally invested in it. But I actually think it was more like 20 years ago when our culture really started to turn. I mean, we talked about this, when was it, last week or 2 weeks ago? You know, when the OJ trial happened, that really, there was this real shift to more of a tabloid culture.
Yeah.
You know, and it kind of took off with that OJ trial. And, you know, and that was the whole, I mean, that permeated everything. But, you know, because even like the, you know, it was like the 20, suddenly there's like the 24-hour news ticker everywhere. And, you know, so that was all part of that. But, you know, now I think even since then, you know, in the last 10 to 15 years, I think innovation and technology advancements have had a huge influence on kind of making that even more, the lines even more blurred, you know, because all of these things have changed the way we access information. The emergence of social media, the way that it has permeated society, you know, it's totally changed the way we receive content. And it's sort of become all about, you know, the 3-second video clip or the powerful image or a pithy statement, you know, that those platforms really lend themselves to that, which means that they actually really, they kind of lend themselves more to that whole kind of entertainment world in a way, you know?
Well, that's a good, yeah, that's a good point.
And then it now starts to cross over. I mean, like you said, you know, we have a reality show star in the White House, but also, you know, many celebrities, including our president, use things like that to communicate news firsthand to the world. And so then that starts to become a place where people get news and it gets picked up by the mainstream media. And it's almost as if, you know, it's almost as if like the subjects of news, especially in the entertainment world, they start driving the news agenda. It's a very bizarre,
yeah, no,
atmosphere.
Yeah, like you said, the lines have been blurred, and I'm just wondering if that's good or bad. I don't know whether we have placed so much importance, and you make a really good point about the OJ thing. I think there was a couple of things. I think now that you say that, I think the OJ thing was a huge thing, as we talked about at the same time. At the same time, there was the Rodney King incident, which, you know, to your point, was broadcast for 24 hours. You saw that beating,
all the time,
over and over. And those were around the same time. And then something that we will be also celebrating at the end of August was the death of Princess Diana, 20th.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was that may have been the culmination of that, because that literally, I mean, if OJ, you know, occupied our lives for 6 to 8 months or almost a year with that trial, beginning when he was arrested until his acquittal. And obviously the Rodney King thing didn't last that long, but it was, you know, impactful. If you remember the summer of 77, don't forget, 3 weeks or so before Lady Di was killed, Johnny Versace was killed by Andrew Cunanan.
In 1997, yeah.
Yeah, 97. And so Andrew Cunanan killed Versace, and that was once again a huge news story, but once again it played into the whole world of fashion and pop culture, so that helped things mix. And Princess Diana, you know, once again, her celebrity was very pop culture driven. You know, she wasn't just a royal.
Oh, yeah.
She was on every tabloid, how she dressed, what she did.
Oh, yeah. She was beautiful. She was stylish.
You know,
people wanted to see what she was wearing. They wanted to know what she was doing. And, you know, and in many ways, that's what the celebrity culture we live in today is kind of about. And so I think it has, you know, it does start to become...
But I'm just wondering, is that good? I mean, I'm, you know,
ingrained in our culture.
I'm just wondering, is it, but, you know, are we so preoccupied, you know, when you look at the rise of the Kardashians of popularity for the sake of being popular, you know, like you said, and that's a really good point, what you made about, it's, what's funny is the technology is responsible for the disposable celebrity that we have today. You know, now everybody's a celebrity, but they're, you know, talk about how prescient Andy Warhol was when he said everybody in the future, everybody will be popular for 15 minutes.
Right.
I mean, that is so true. And he said that like in the 60s or 70s, long before any of this kind of, but my gosh, he looks like an amazing, he looks like Nostradamus.
Right.
You know, and but to your point.
Yeah, it is true.
But like, you know, like you're saying, the reason that like what everything has moved even faster, the 24-hour cable news is what helped create the OJ trial and its impact and the Lady Di thing. And now, and don't forget, now 20 years ago, that stuff, you still had to go into a place and watch a television.
Right.
But now I turn to my right, and as I'm talking, there's Kevin, the producer, and he's clearly not listening.
He's bored out of his mind.
He's totally bored out of his mind, and he's on his phone checking. There must be something. I mean, not to be sad or anything, but someone in his family must have died, because why else would he be doing that in front of me? But my point is, and I'm just joking, but my point is here, I mean, we are now, this thing is so, you know, that's what's made the shift. It's not the access, it's the mobility. Now, you know, 24-hour television, you still had to go and find a TV. But now that TV is in your back pocket. And so you could take it anywhere. So now, I mean, I don't know what everybody's texting about or what they're watching, but we are so inundated that, to your point, which is really correct, it's the device that has really created the culture that we're in now. It's not so much what's happening is important, it's just that we have immediate access to it, and now the ability to immediately have our opinion broadcast about it.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, and that goes, that's whether you're a celebrity or whether you are a civilian. But, you know, I mean, celebrities these days, I mean, whether they're Instagramming stuff or tweeting it out, I mean, they're, you know, it's everywhere. They're controlling a message. Like I said, you know, you have Donald Trump. I mean, when he announced his the ban on transgender people from serving in the military, that he announced that on Twitter. He didn't hold a traditional press conference like, you know, historically presidents would do for that type of announcement.
And I got news for you. I got news for you. Once again, I don't have any. I'm not a big Trump supporter. I'm enjoying standing on the outside and watching both sides combat each other. I think it's really an interesting thing. I it's interesting the way the far left or the liberals are attacking him, and it's interesting how he's attacking them. And I don't have any horse in the race. And the last time I bet on a horse, it was Emily's entourage, and it came in sixth. So thanks to
and
you,
I stole you $10.
Yeah, you still say that. That's why you don't want to let me know you're in town.
It's the $10.
You're a cheapskate. You don't want to pay my $10. But but I guarantee you, as much as Trump is lambasted on a daily basis, especially by the Washington, you know, media that covers him every day about this Twitter thing, and they're tell him to stop Twittering, and Twitter, stop. I got news for you. Whoever the next president is, from now on, Twitter is a major communication device for the president of the United States. It will, whoever is next,
that's what I'm saying.
He or she may not Twitter with the same regularity and perhaps without the thought process behind it like he does. He's just very spontaneous on it. But
right. But
what he has done has shown the power to like you just said, that's how the president is now in today's world communicating major news. And every president after him will continue to do that. That's going to be ultimately, I don't know if he's ever going to pass a bill for infrastructure or immigration or healthcare, but what his legacy will be is he will have established Twitter as an official presidential means of communication. At the very least, every presidential candidate and every president from now on will use Twitter in some way to communicate to the people on a daily basis.
And this is the thing, though. It's like, I mean, two things. First of all, you know, that this is how, so this is how the president is communicating out things. So, you know, the media, I mean, that is real news. You know, like if there's a ban on transgender people serving in the military, that is news and people need to know about that. But, and so now you've got the media. I mean, they're not, you know, 20 years ago when we were working in media, if you wanted a lot of journalists to know about something, it had to go over the wire and they're watching the wire.
Right.
And now they're watching Twitter.
Yeah.
And so there is. So now there's legitimate news that's now being communicated, you know, by people like the president. But then you've also got all this other fluffy stuff. But it starts to make that seem like real news, even
right.
if it's not. You know.
Well, so, and not only that, you've got. Not only do you have. So yeah, I mean that's another great point. So I never thought of that. So you've got both the president and your grandmother talking about how proud she is of your A on your report card, using the same communication, you know,
right,
you know, and
platform.
So it's the same platform, and so to your point, then it all starts to get mashed up, and so either they're all of the meanings of the stuff on Twitter is either elevated, or you can make the argument that it's the standard has gone down because the president now is using the same platform as your grandmother. You could say that now your grandmother's whatever she says has been elevated, or you could look at it and say what the president says has been de-elevated or, you know, lowered because now he's using the same platform as your grandmother.
Right.
And I don't know if that's good. I mean, I wish I had any answers.
I mean,
I'm just bringing it up as a question, but I don't know if this is good or bad. I guess, you know, it's going to take 10 or 15 years for all this to flesh out, but we are in such a weird transformational time right now. I don't know. I mean, I don't know where we're at right now, to be honest with you.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you were too young, and I wasn't all that old, but I'm looking back at it now, and I just really equate where we're at now with the 70s. 70s were also very transformational for several reasons, and hate to sound like Debbie Downer, but it wasn't until the mid-80s when we got out of that funk. So this could be around for a while.
Oh, no. Don't.
Yeah.
Don't.
I'm just saying. And, you know, what I love, too, is, you know, there's all this 70s nostalgia now, you know. And it's all, you know, it's all everybody's, you know, once again, you know, you're 20 years away or 40 years away. So it's easy to just pick the positive stuff. And the 70s were a really difficult and mixed up and tough time on many levels, culturally, economically. There was high inflation, meat prices, gas, energy. I mean, it was not a. I mean, the Vietnam War. I mean, this was the 70s. Was not a fun place to be. There was some good things. There were some happy things. But, you know, Watergate. We had a president resign for the first time. There's a lot of turmoil in the 70s.
Right.
But now when there's 70s nostalgia, everybody's disco dancing, or they've got the hippie flowers. And they're playing.
Oh, vinyl is back. You know, 70s fashion is back too. So is 90s fashion, which is a bit weird. But
I heard this. I heard somebody on one of those bad entertainment shows go, "Oh, I just love the 70s." And I was sitting there going, "Do you know how terrible the 70s were to live in?" It's like, no. There's nothing to. I mean, there's, you know, but there's such a of just a cosmetic and view of the 70s now. If you really want to dig deep into the 70s, it was a really, really mixed up time. And there was a lot of dissension, just like today, between the Vietnam War, as I said, the politicians and Nixon and the pardon and, like I said, the gas prices and the, you know, there was a shortage on meat. I mean, there was a ton of stuff going on. It was not, you know, all peaches and cream. And
See, now, so now, do you think 40 years from now, people are going to look back and be like, whoa, the 20 teens, that was a really messed up time.
Whoa, no, I don't think it's going to take that long. I think it's going to be about 2 years from now, because everything moves faster. and this is the one thing, and I want to get political, and we'll, because I don't, you know, it's not, you can go other places to listen to all that stuff. But here's my one thing that I want to say about this whole thing with Trump and everything that's going on right now. I have no idea what's going to happen. But all I can say is, if you hate Trump, if you're bashing Trump, if you know all these people that are bashing Trump, all you're doing is assuring that he's going to run for re-election. Because in my view, I think he was, I don't think he ever expected to be president. I don't think he necessarily even wanted to be president. I think he realized, okay, I won, I will do my service, but I think he's got a short attention span. I think he would have been for and out. He would have said, you know what? I won this. I'm glad I gave voice to a part of the constituency in the country that felt a little out. So I'm glad I was able to do that. We're on the way to make the America better. I hope I started that trend. But you know what? I'm 74 years old right now. I've got a young kid, and I want to take some time. I'm glad with the progress. I'm going to hand it off.
He's got businesses.
Yeah, and I think he would have left after 4 years. But now he is being so lambasted for everything he does or says. And like I said, I'm not judging the merits. I'm just saying he is getting attacked on a daily basis, on an hourly basis. I think he's going to run out of spite. He's going to run to say, you know what? I wasn't going to run. But now just because.
But now I'm going to.
But now I'm going to. And I got news for you. Right now, I don't see who beats him. Who beats him?
A lot can happen.
Well, I understand that, but I'm just saying is.
Or 3.5 years.
If you didn't like Donald Trump, you just should have let him be, because he would have lost interest and gone away. But now he's got a new enemies list, and he's going to say, you know what? I'm going to run again just out of spite, just because you don't want me to, because that's Donald Trump. If they would have let him go, he would have got bored with the job and left after 4 years. So it's counterproductive, because I got news for you. He's not going to resign, and they're not going to impeach him in the next 3 years. That's not going to happen.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. You're right. So, you don't want to make him mad.
He'll
tweeting about you.
Exactly.
Ask
Rosie O'Donnell. You don't want to get him mad.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing. But yeah, I don't know where our culture is going, and we're all in it. And I look at, I watch the news, and I just say Walter Cronkite, you know, would not be announcing that Beyonce had twins.
Beyonce.
Oh, I'm sorry, Beyonce. I'm sorry, it's Beyonce, right?
Yes, I think you'll find it's pronounced Beyonce, at least on this podcast.
Well, the funny thing is, so I filled in the other night here at WGN Radio for the 7 to 11 host. His name is Justin Kaufman, and he calls his show The Download, you know. And so I filled in for 2 hours of the shift. They split the shift off. So I was doing 9 to 11, and so I called it Elton Jim's flip phone.
Oh,
he could have the download. I'm still on my flip phone.
I like that.
Yeah, so it was Elton Jim's flip phone. So, Emily, what are we going to do except, once again, I can't believe that you didn't tell me you're in town. I don't know. I mean, how many times?
I was going to tell you, and then I was like, I don't think, at least on this visit,
That's fine.
But I will, but I like
it. What I love about you just saying that, the city. Okay, you're in the suburbs. You know, we have.
In the suburbs.
Yeah, I understand that. Okay, you know what? We don't get around by horse and buggy. It doesn't take 3 days.
We have had.
You didn't have an hour.
It's not an hour. For me to get to see you for 1 hour in the city.
No, I drive. I would drive to you.
An hour to get there, an hour to get back.
No,
oh, you
I would.
Could.
I would.
Oh, I didn't know you would do that.
Well, of course I would.
Oh, that's really sweet.
Yeah, a lot of good that does. I mean, of course I would have. If you said, look, you know, I don't have that time. If you want to meet somewhere here. I drove an hour to sell my baseball cards 2 weeks ago.
I knew I was going to get in trouble for this.
Well, you should be in trouble because you still owe me $10 from that hunch bet.
We will make a plan. I will message you my dates for my next visit coming up very soon.
You just told me, well, why don't you go to Ravinia, right? You said I should meet you at Ravinia, right?
No, I didn't.
How was I going to get there? Was I going to take it? Was I going to walk to Ravinia and take? What, I would leave now to get to Ravinia because it's in Highland Park. So, I mean, I would have to travel there. Right?
Well, yes, you would. You could also, though, you could take the train.
Yes, I could take the train to the suburbs, too. Do you realize how transportation has advanced?
It's amazing.
It's amazing. There are trains, planes, and automobiles.
Okay.
I'm just giving you a hard time. Did you bring James with you or just you?
I did bring James.
Oh, I could see James, too.
What do you think I did? Left him, like,
well, I don't know.
At home.
I don't know if it was some madcap girls weekend or something.
No, it's actually a family trip. Which
so you don't think that James?
I don't have as much flexibility as I
so you
might
don't,
have.
But so you don't think that James would want to see his namesake?
Oh, he would love to. Are
yeah.
you kidding me?
Well, you deprived him of that. I hope you, that's nice.
Well,
happy Mother's Day.
Maybe we. Oh boy! Now I'm going to be in even more trouble than James hears this.
I know. Hey, James, just know that I was within 20 miles of you for a week, and James, just could you let your mom know? There's also a thing called a highway. You can actually drive like 65 or 70 miles an hour. So sometimes to go 20 miles, it takes about 30 minutes. So, James, I was 30 minutes away from you.
No, triple that.
I was 30 minutes away, and your mom just blew me off.
For traffic.
Blew me off. James, I sat there one time and lectured your mom on the lyrics to Tiny Dancer, and yet she does not pay me back. We will, well, I'll have to think about it. Maybe we'll talk to you next week or not. I don't know.
Oh,
I may have.
There we go.
Because, you know, I don't know. Is there a way to communicate? I mean, you live in Texas. Is there a way for us to communicate? Is there a device that has been.
That, if only there were some.
Yeah, I hope. I wish there was some kind of a sonic thing that our voices could at least. We couldn't see each other, but maybe I'll ask Kevin in the next week if we could devise some way that we can somehow communicate just with our voices. And if I could find that, then I will have you on next week. All right?
Fair enough.
Okay. Always fun, or at least it used to be. Thank you, Emily.
Thanks, Tim.
Take care. Oh, I went a little longer today, but it's a podcast. I know Kevin has to get home, but once a week, deal with it. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto here. Hope you enjoyed episode 66 of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode goes up at WGNplus.com. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. This is the only podcast that goes from the end of the web to your screen.